Good afternoon. This is Enid Monthly In Depth, and I'm here with Stephen Jones. How are you doing today, Stephen?
Fine, Bobby. Thank you.
Well, Stephen is a longtime member of the legal community here in Enid, and we're really excited to get to know Stephen as Stephen and some of the things that he has gone through, where he grew up, and his family life and that sort of thing. Is that okay with you, Stephen?
That's fine. Thank you for your interest.
Well, good. Well, Stephen, tell us a little bit about where you were born.
I was born in Lafayette, Louisiana, in 1940. So I'll be 81. And my parents moved from there to Houston, Texas fairly early. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Houston, except for 2 years we lived in Tyler, Texas, and 2 years I lived in Seminole, Oklahoma. The rest of the time I lived in Houston or a suburb.
Okay. Well, so does that make your parents, were they Cajuns then?
If they my father worked in the oil field.
Okay.
And he was from Houston. My mother was from Tennessee.
Okay. Well, my family, my dad and grandparents, and they were all from Southeast Louisiana or Southwest Louisiana. And so they were Cajun through and through.
Sure, but, sure, of course.
And then moved up to Oklahoma City later on. So you were in Houston when you, is that where you grew up and went to school?
Yes. Houston. Most of the time we lived in Bel Air, which was a suburb of Houston, but very close in. Mm-hmm. So the difference between Houston and Bel Air was a railroad track and a road, so it was really part of a larger Houston area.
Okay. Did you have brothers and sisters?
Nope, I'm the only child.
Only child, wow, okay. And so you said your dad was in the oil field.
Yes.
What did he do?
He, from the time that I was conscious of what my father did, he worked for the National Lead Company, which was a Fortune 500 company, and it had a subsidiary named Baroid, which was the largest manufacturer of drilling muds, and my father was in charge of their international department, and so he traveled all over the world selling Baroid to developing countries and to established countries wherever there was an oil field. So he went really, I would say, everywhere except, of course, the two poles, and I don't think he ever went into a communist country.
Mm-hmm.
Might have gone to Yugoslavia once, but other than that, it was Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Canada, and some in the Far East, and in Western Europe.
Okay, and so your mom, was she a homemaker?
She was a homemaker part of the time, but she had a very lucky job, fortunate job. A good friend of hers named Livis Devine was the personal secretary to her brother, whose name was Harris Masterson. The Mastersons were old family. His grandfather had been United States Senator and Lieutenant Governor and publisher of the Houston Post. And Mr. Masterson had married the niece of a former governor. They were very affluent. He had a flat at the Dakota in New York, where John Lennon lived, a flat in London, and a beautiful estate home in Houston, and my mother was his personal bookkeeper.
I see. During that time, did you end up graduating from a school in Houston?
Yes.
Were you active in sports or anything like that?
No. You extinguish that, please. High school debate. I was not interested in sports at all, so my extracurricular activities were either student council, politics, or debate.
So you knew early what you wanted to do.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So is that when you decided to be a lawyer, was while you were going through school?
I would say probably, Bobby, my third year at the University of Texas.
Okay. So that's where you went to undergrad.
Well, I came to OU first for his year, and then I went to the University of Texas at Austin for the last 3 years.
So why did you go to OU from being down in Southern Texas?
Part of the reason was that my high school debate coach, a wonderful woman named Molly Martin, had graduated from Central State and taught debate at Purcell, had a lot of winners and champions, and when Bel Air High School opened, it was the first new public high school in Houston, and they had 1,000 applicants for the position. She applied and was hired by the principal, who was a prominent man. Two of his brothers were major Hollywood actors, and he was prominent in the Baptist Church, and Molly produced a group of winners, and she was from Oklahoma, spoke highly of Oklahoma, and so I decided to come to OU for a year to see how I liked Oklahoma, and went back to Texas, and then came back to Oklahoma for law school.
Okay. So you ended up graduating from the University of Texas, Austin?
No, I entered law school under what used to be called Plan 3, which is no longer available. Now, everyone, to be admitted to law school, has to have an undergraduate degree. But back 60 years ago, that wasn't true. In fact, some law schools would accept you without an undergraduate degree, some with only 2 years, but OU would accept students who had 3 years. Well, I actually had 4 years, but if you didn't have an undergraduate degree, it didn't make any difference. If you had the requisite 90 hours, they would accept you. And in those days, very few people went to law school. I mean, there wasn't any waiting list or anything like that. So I studied and majored in English, minored in history. And without a degree plan, then I could take any course I wanted to. I didn't have to fulfill requirements. So I thought I got a very well-rounded education at the University of Texas.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you came up to OU and then finished law school there at OU. Was it a traditional three-year program like it is
now?
Yes,
yes.
Okay. And you took the Oklahoma bar?
I did.
And did you decide that you just wanted to stay in Oklahoma at that point?
Well, by that time, I really liked Oklahoma. Molly had really enhanced my view of it, and I'd worked for the Republican Party of Texas at their state committee, and I thought the Republicans in Texas, and right after we'd elected John Tower to the Senate, were way more conservative than me, and I was just sort of uncomfortable with their political ideology, and I felt Oklahoma, frankly, was a better place to live. It was smaller, more compact. It was possible to know everything that was going on in the state. And I liked the people. And perhaps more important, other than Henry Bellman being our first Republican governor, because he played a major role in my coming, was the fact that there were many people still alive, Bobby, who had been active in territorial politics. And I interviewed all of those, well, I should say all of them, a large number of them. I interviewed the widow of the last territorial governor, the daughter of the first governor, one of the surviving members of the Constitutional Convention, the first president pro tempore of the Senate. And I even found an elderly man in Muskogee who had been a Republican in Congress for one term, elected with William Howard Taft.
Interesting. So why did you interview him? What was the purpose of the interview?
I was writing my senior thesis on Oklahoma's political history, which ultimately 10 years later was published. And so I had the interest to make the history and the study of Oklahoma politics as comprehensive as possible throughout the history of the territory as well as the state. And those people had remarkable memories. And there were a number of files that were still available, archives. And I wanted the book, obviously I wanted to credit the university, but the book was later published, and I wanted it to be as complete as possible.
Did you still have that book?
I do. They're not many copies, but I have some, yes.
Okay, we'll have to take a look at one of those and read them. So at the time, the Oklahoma politics were mostly Democratic, is that correct?
Yes. Mr. Bellman was the only Republican holding statewide office. And as I said, he was the first Republican governor, and we had one of the six congressmen. And in the state house, there were easily enough Democrats, Bobby, to have impeached and removed Bellman or to override a veto. But Governor Bellman had a unique personality, and he had an excellent staff. But there were only six Republicans in the Senate out of 44, and only, I think, 25 or 21 in the House out of 101.
So about the polar opposite of what it
polar
is.
Polar opposite of what it is today.
So what? So were you always interested in Republican politics, even as a student?
From the time General Eisenhower ran the first time in 52, I was.
Okay. And so when you said that that you got to know Governor Bellman pretty well, is that where you went to work after law school?
Actually, I started working in his administration during law school. I was very fortunate. The woman that was one of the two secretaries at the Republican State Committee headquarters in Austin had been Henry Bellman's secretary when he was state chairman. Mm-hmm. So she arranged the introduction of the governor and myself and Drew Mason, who was the governor's administrative assistant. And she had been secretary to both of them, introduced me to both of them, and they were enormously helpful in getting me started in Oklahoma.
What was your first position with them?
First position, I worked for a state agency of which I didn't even know it existed, called the State Agency for Surplus Property.
Okay.
And its advantage to me and to the governor was I was an inspector. And so I could drive anywhere in the state and use that to inspect how facilities like schools or hospitals were using surplus property they had purchased from the state. Well, the main advantage to me was I had a license to drive anywhere. First place I came was Enid. Mm-hmm. And
was that because this is the area where Governor Bowman grew up?
Or? No, I sort of developed an interest in Enid in Texas. I was looking around, and I made a list of five characteristics of where I wanted to live, and Enid was the only one that met all five. And the more I studied it, the more I thought, well, this is the place to go. And if there was any doubt in my mind, former Governor Henry Johnston, who was still alive, he was about 93, over in Perry, I told him, Governor, I'm considering, I knew him and met him, and you can understand it was important to Governor Bowman that a former governor who was so elderly from Perry, because Governor Bowman lived in Noble County, that he feel involved. So I would go up on Sunday afternoons and spend 2 or 3 hours with Governor, and we would talk. And I asked him one time, I said, Governor, I'd like your advice. I'm thinking of three places, Guthrie, Muskogee, and Enid. And I wondered if you could evaluate them for me. He said, well, Muskogee's a dying town. Don't go to Muskogee. Besides that, it's Democratic. You won't do anything there. Guthrie, there's nothing going on in Guthrie since Charlie Haskell and I moved to the state capital of Oklahoma City. Enid, that's a different deal. And so he told me a lot about Enid, and of course I've been over here and I met people. And as I said, Enid was the only one that met all five. But, make a long story short, I dropped out of law school for a while to work for Richard Nixon as his personal assistant. And then after law school, I went to Washington and worked several years. So I didn't actually come to Enid permanently until May 5th, 1969.
Okay, so let's talk about that. You just kind of threw that in that you worked for Richard Nixon, President Nixon. How did, was that before he was president?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
And what was he doing then?
Mr. Nixon, if you remember, after Mr. Kennedy had defeated him, he moved back to California and he joined the Adams Dookie law firm. And then he ran for governor in 1962 and was decisively defeated.
In California?
In California. Right. Pat Brown beat him. And he wanted to come back to New York. He thought New York was the fast action. He thought he was through with politics. So he had a couple of older men that had taken a career interest in him. And they introduced him to their law firm. And their law firm was looking for a rainmaker. And they thought, well, who better than a man that almost became president? So he moved to New York in October of 63, was admitted to the New York bar on January 1, and Mrs. Nixon, I believe, joined him either over Thanksgiving or Christmas, and I came to work for him about the second or third week of January.
And this is in New York?
In New York, uh-huh. At his office, a room. There were three of us in a room about half this size, myself, Loie Gaunt, who was his office manager, and Rosemary Woods, who was his famous secretary. And then next to our office was Mr. Nixon's office. He had a corner office. And then out front of our office was Shelley Scarney, who's now Mrs. Patrick Buchanan, and she was Mr. Nixon's receptionist. My job was to help him with his research.
I see. And so he was a new lawyer then? You said
he... he'd been at the California bar, but he was new.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. So what made you decide to go work for Mr. Nixon?
He asked me to.
Okay. So how did you get in contact with him through working?
I'd met him a couple of times.
Because Oklahoma wouldn't be a stomping grounds, right?
No, and I was very young. I later learned that wasn't so unusual to be young, but Mr. Nixon had, we had some mutual contacts, and he had read a paper that I had written, which impressed him, and so he just wrote me. I came home from law school one day at lunch, it was semester break, and he said, I've signed some contracts writing and I need a research assistant. And I've got Steve Hess in Washington, but I need somebody in New York. And if you're interested, the job is yours and come to New York. And we'll interview and talk about it. But if you want to come, come.
So is that the reason why you dropped out of law school at the time?
Yeah, I dropped out and he told me, I saw him on a Saturday morning about 10 o'clock at his office. He said, well, I can use you to the Republican National Convention. And he said, after that, I don't think I'll be the nominee, and writing assignments will be completed. And I can either transfer you to the Presidential Candidates Organization or the Republican National Committee. Well, I really wasn't interested in doing that. I was not a supporter of Senator Goldwater. And I didn't think the National Committee would be nearly as exciting as working for Mr. Nixon. So I asked him if I'd go back to Norman, and I asked him if I could take the train back so that I could see the country. And he said, well, sure. So he got, or his secretary got for me, a Pullman ticket, New York Central. And I went to Illinois, Chicago overnight, left New York. Stayed 8 hours in Chicago and then took the Santa Fe down to Norman.
Mm-hmm. And that's when you went back to law school?
That's when I went back to law school.
Okay. And then ultimately you graduated from
OU?
Yes,
I did.
Did you come to Enid straight from there then?
No. Again, Governor Bellman and Drew Mason had asked me to help Robert Lavender, who was the first Republican on the Supreme Court in decades. And the governor had appointed Justice Lavender. He was the second Republican holding statewide office, but he had to come up for election in 18 months, and they needed somebody to help the justice with his campaign because it was still partisan elections. So they called me to the Capitol and said, it's time to pay your marker. And they'd done so much for me, so we need you to help. They called him Bob, but Justice Lavender. So every Thursday, either I picked the justice up or he picked me up, and we would go to a county that I had chosen. And I would say, now you need to see this person who's a newspaper publisher or county chairman or Farm Bureau president. And that was to get ready for the 66 campaign. So I was also working for Dewey Bartlett, who was running for governor, and was his research man. And they decided to send me to a 17-state Republican kind of confidential campaign management workshop in a rural setting in Illinois, which turned out to be a wonderful estate. And while I was there, I met Raymond Humphreys, who worked for the National Committee, and was a bachelor from West Virginia, been on MacArthur's staff, and had been a former member of the West Virginia House of Representatives. And he said he wanted to help my career, so he put me with Congressman Paul Finley. And so as soon as I graduated law school, I went to work as Mr. Finley's administrative assistant. And then during that time, I worked briefly for Senator Chuck Percy of Illinois and Congressman Don Rumsfeld, who was also from Illinois.
The Don Rumsfeld that
became the youngest and the oldest Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
Yep.
And so you were intimately interested in politics, then, it sounds like.
I was intimately interested. I had wonderful bosses, wonderful opportunities, and I felt I was right at the heart of things.
Okay. Did you ultimately ran for office, correct?
I did. Fortunately, I wasn't elected.
And that was a little bit later.
Oh, yeah, that was later.
Okay. So when did you actually come to Enid? You were moving around the United States.
May 5th, 1969.
Okay. So late 60s. Was that the oil boom still going on at that point?
No. I went to work for Auchin and Carter, Senator Auchin. I met, they had asked me to join them in 1965, but I'd gone to Washington.
Now, you said Senator Auchin, that right. Some people might not know, was he a state
senator?
Well,
he was a state senator. He was the leader of the Republicans in the state Senate in the 20s. Uh-huh. And in fact, he was the only Republican that was a House manager, that is, prosecutor of Governor Jack Walton when Walton stood trial and the Senate was removed. And Mr. Auchin had a Republican pedigree. His uncle was a Republican congressman from Milwaukee who had appointed Douglas MacArthur to West Point as a cadet. And Mr. Auchin was the Republican nominee for governor in 1942 and narrowly lost. I mean, it's very close. And Mr. Carter had been mayor of Enid, member of the American College of Trial Lawyers. So they were great mentors for me.
Okay, and so you moved up here and did, what was the general practice that you had at the time?
They, Mr. Carter had wonderful clients. He represented Union Equity, which is the grain company, Surveyor, which was the civilian contractor, George Failing, the oil field drilling rig, and he was general counsel for the Oklahoma Farm Bureau and the Oklahoma Farm Bureau Insurance Company.
So mostly civil practice.
Yes, oh yes. But both he and the senator had had some major criminal cases earlier in their career.
Mm-hmm. Back then, it was pretty common to be, even if you were a civil lawyer, to be appointed to criminal cases.
And that's how I got started. I asked to get on the list, and most lawyers tried to shy away from it, but I thought it was very interesting.
Okay. And so did you enjoy your time in Enid at that time?
Absolutely. Well, I've never regretted either moving to Enid or staying here after a trial in Denver.
Okay. And so you were here in 69, and did you just build your practice with Mr. Auchin and just thrive that way? Is that what happened?
No. An incident happened, became a national news incident. On May the 4th, or May 3rd, the president, who was Mr. Nixon, authorized what was called an incursion, but actually an invasion of Cambodia. And there was a tremendous pushback on college campuses and the anti-war protest. And the next day, four students at Kent State in Ohio were shot by young men who were members of the Ohio National Guard. And when that happened, there was an eruption in the country that was probably five times the intensity of the George Floyd murder. And there were over 1,000 campuses that the students shut down. And the day after that day, OU remained open largely because of the leadership of Herbert Holloman, who was president, but it was a very tense situation. There was a young student named Keith Green, who was an anti-war protester, and he had a homemade Viet Cong flag that had been used in a model student, model UN, and he put the flag on a pole and went to the Army ROTC drill, which was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and started waving the flag in and among the cadets. And when he did that, there were three or four law students who told the chief of police at OU that that was a felony and showed them the statute, and they arrested Keith, put him in the squad car, and when they did that, about 800 to 900 students sat down around the car. And they wouldn't move, and they had insufficient numbers to move them. So the governor authorized the Oklahoma Highway Patrol and units of the National Guard to come to Norman and the campus and remove the students one by one.
And which governor was this?
Bartlett.
Bartlett.
And Keith was taken down to jail at 10 o'clock at night, made bond, was released, and then went to 12 lawyers to find a lawyer to represent him. None of those lawyers would take his case, even though his family could certainly afford it. And one of the lawyers was a friend of mine named Phil Horning. And Phil said he couldn't take it, but he said, but I've got a friend in Enid that just started practicing and he might be interested. So Keith called me and I said, well, if you can come to Enid, I'll talk to you about it. And he said, well, I don't drive, but I'll take the bus. So he took the bus from Norman to Oklahoma City, changed buses, came into the bus station, you know, which used to be down here, came to my office.
I wouldn't know. So yeah. Down, when you say down?
Well, down. It's over, it'd be Washington and Adams, maybe.
Okay.
And he walked to my office, which was in what we call the Bass Building then, it's Triangle Building now. And the first thing I noticed about him was it was obvious that he had very limited vision. He was legally blind. In the meantime, I read the newspapers and I found out that the United States Supreme Court had declared the so-called red flag statutes unconstitutional in 1930. So I told him, I said, well, you have a defense. And
First Amendment.
Yes, First Amendment. Uh-huh. And because the Oklahoma statute had been passed in 1921. It was very similar to the California statute that had been struck down. So he asked me to represent him. He said his father would send me a check. His father was the chief engineer for Texaco in the United Kingdom. And so the day of the preliminary hearing,
Cleveland County,
I told Mr. Carter, I said, Mr. Carter, I'm going down to Norman for that red flag case. Well, in hindsight, in view of what happened, my understanding of red flag was different than Frank Carter's. He thought it was something to do with, you know, Big Red, Boomer Sooner. Mm-hmm. So I went down for the preliminary hearing, and they had a hard time binding Keith over. But they finally bound him over, and as we were walking out of the courtroom, there were two young reporters. And the female asked me, what are you going to do next? And I didn't know what I was going to do next. But I said, well, I'm going to take this case all the way to federal court, whatever that meant. Well, fortunately, Bobby, every newspaper in the state of Oklahoma gave it about that much attention, which was more than it deserved. But in Enid, in the Enid Daily Eagle, the next afternoon, above the fold, three columns on the right, headline, Enid lawyer to take Viet Cong flag case to federal court.
And when you say red flag laws, do you mean, was that intentional?
Yeah, that's what it was called, yes.
Like communism?
Right. Okay. We were in military conflict in Vietnam, and Keith's actions, but for the First Amendment, met the offense. And Mr. Carter came in to see me, and I could tell he was upset, which I understood. And he said, well, Stephen, you'll either have to drop the case or leave the firm. And I said, well, Mr. Carter, he's paid me. I've already spent the money. I don't have a conflict, and he's got a defense, so I don't see how I can drop the case. But I said, I understand, and I thank you for the opportunity. And he asked me if I could stay 30 days, and I said, certainly. And I just put it down to a generational difference. But that night, he and Mrs. Carter went to Oakwood Country Club, and he caught unshirted hell. Mm-hmm. So the next day, I came to the office, and there was an ominous silence. But I could hear the Xerox machine, one of those old style bulky. It was click, 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 which I thought was a little strange. So I asked one of the secretaries, I said, Dodie, what's going on? And she said, I can't tell you. But she said, come by my desk in 10 minutes. So I waited and came by her desk in 10 minutes. And there on front of the desk was a firm stationery with my name marked through. And Mr. Carter written, to our class, please be advised, Mr. Jones has resigned from our firm. And attached to it was the newspaper article. I said, what are you all doing with these? She said, he's mailing them out. I said, are you kidding me? I said, how many? She said, well, by 5,000.
Oh, wow.
I said, you've got to be kidding. No.
So every prominent person in
Eden. Well, and the bar and every member of country club all over. So I went into Mr. Carter and I said, Mr. Carter, can I visit with you for a minute? And he looked at the clock and said, well, see, I got to go out to Failing. I'll be back, how about 3 o'clock? I said, or 4 o'clock, well, late in the afternoon. I said, that's fine. I've got to go to Dallas. I'll wait for you. So time passed, and finally, by 4 o'clock, he hadn't come back. So Doty came in and told me, said, Stephen, I need to tell Mr. Carter's not coming back. So I said, well, thank you. So I didn't know many people in Eden, but I went over to Judge Lamerton, asked if I could see him, and he said, sure. So I handed him one of the letters, and I told him what was going on, and he said, where's Frank? I said, well, I think he's at George E. Failing Company. So he told Nellie Mae Lewis, his court reporter, get Frank Carter on the phone. So she calls out and tells him that Judge Park Lamerton wants to talk to him, and I'm sitting in the office, and Mr. Carter comes on the phone, and Judge Lamerton says, Frank, what are you doing? I guess Mr. Carter told him. And Judge Lamerton said, well, I'm telling you, you shouldn't do that. And I guess Mr. Carter said he was going to do it. And Judge Lamerton, I've never forgotten this, he looked at the wall, and there was a clock. And he said, Frank, I want you to remember that at 4:45 on May 8th, 1970, I told you this is not going to turn out the way you think it is. And hung up the phone, handed me back the letter. Said, well, I'm sorry. I said, I understand, Judge. Sunday, I was driving back from Dallas, where I'd spent the weekend, and I had NBC News on. National News, I think it was called Monitor or something. I was outside Paul's Valley on the old highway, and the news came on, and I led the news. National News. An Enid, Oklahoma lawyer has been fired from his law firm for defending an OU student carrying a Viet Cong flag. And I thought, oh my God. I pulled off to the side of the road to listen, went into town, bought several newspapers, there it was. Got home, and there were lots of phone calls, and Richard Caron came by to see me.
Well, at the time, were you concerned that you were finished in Enid?
I think I was in a state of shock. Mm-hmm. And Richard came by that afternoon when I got back, probably about 8 o'clock, said, I got some space down at my office, and you're welcome to office.
And this is Richard?
Caron. Okay. He's a lawyer here, a great lawyer, fundamental, the best tax lawyer I ever saw. And
why do you think he did that? Did you have a personal relationship with him?
I didn't. I mean, well, he was a member of St. Matthew's Episcopal Church, so I knew him casually, but I didn't have any kind of close relationship with him. But he rented from Ken Martin, and so I got a room with a desk, and I went out to Thurman Bridge and Block, bought some black cinder blocks, and got some lumber, and made some bookshelves out of the blocks and the lumber, put my law books on it, started practicing.
Okay. Well, it sounds like being a Republican back in the 50s in Oklahoma, taking a case like that, that up here was, I would guess, would be a relatively conservative area that wasn't involved in a lot of the protests that maybe Norman was in some of those areas. So it sounds like that you kind of had a heart for the underdog even back then.
I think so, looking back on it. I've always believed, and I'm sure you practice law, so you know, lawyers have a duty to accept court appointments. You've accepted them, I've accepted them. And I think that everyone, as I know you do, believe that a defendant charged with a crime has the right to a lawyer. And that right is empty unless you've got a lawyer that's willing to do it. And I've always believed that the right to counsel was an important part of our Bill of Rights and our Constitution and what you and I learned in law school. And I've seen you do that, and I did it. It's just that this was a very inflammatory situation.
Did you, were you persona non grata for a while here in Enid?
No, not at all. Some people would come up to me privately, Harold Singer, Tim Crowley, Richard, of course. They gave me their support, and clients started coming in.
So doing the right thing ended up being in your favor later on.
Well, I hope it was the right thing. I think it was.
Well, what was the ultimate resolution of the case?
Judge Brown dismissed it. I filed a motion to dismiss, and he called me and said he had read the brief, and he was going to announce a dismissal.
This is the district judge?
Yes, Elvin Brown, who was a very courageous judge. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want to give you a heads up. I want to do that. And so I thanked him, and then I went down to Norma, and he signed the dismissal. I've got the dismissal and Keith's picture committing the felony, so-called, on my wall. And so that was the end of it.
Okay, and that was in the 70s?
It was 1971.
Okay, so you were a really new lawyer then.
I was.
Okay, in the 70s, did you? What was your family life like then? Well, were your parents still living in Houston?
They still lived in Houston. Okay. I was here alone. My wife and I were divorced. She was a pharmacist. She's deceased now. She was a pharmacist, and we'd been married about 10 years. And so I. That was probably 1970, and I married Cheryl at the end of 1973, and I adopted Cheryl's son, and then we had two children, and so we've lived here ever since.
Okay, and when did you purchase the house out north of town?
That was 1979.
Okay, and that's where y'all have lived for the last 42 years. It's a lovely house, and raised all three kids there?
Yes.
Okay. Now, tell me a little bit about your kids. You said you had three kids?
Yes. Rachel, my daughter, is the middle one. She is an assistant United States attorney in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Before that, she was an assistant district attorney. Edward lives in New York. He works for NBC News.
What's his job there?
He's a graphics supervisor. So whenever you see a graphic on MSNBC or NBC News, like the evening broadcast, Edward is one of two supervisors that supervises that and assigns it out. And Stephen lives on the West Coast in San Francisco. And Stephen initially wanted to be an actor and had some small roles, but he was always very good in foreign languages. He speaks about 8. And so in a place like San Francisco, that ability was greatly in demand. And now, pardon me, he has probably the most lucrative job he's ever had. He shows apartments to people that want to rent apartments in San Francisco and then gets a commission. And I talked with him over the weekend. And he said he had 11 showings that weekend.
Well, and if you read the news, San Francisco, it's not uncommon for a $10,000 a month apartment.
Oh, no,
and it being about the size of this room.
That's exactly right. And Rachel went to Westminster and SMU. Edward went to OSU and OU. And then Stephen went to Hamilton in upstate New York. So all three of them went to school, college. I have trouble with you for class. I mean for water.
Now, do they come back home?
Oh yes. Well, they didn't come home this Christmas
because of COVID. Do you have any grandchildren?
No.
No, none yet.
None.
All right. Well, maybe soon.
So, yes.
Was your practice a general practice, a county seat practice that was criminal, civil, representing businesses and that sort of thing?
Not really. It's interesting you mentioned that. Years ago, I sent to every lawyer in town for Christmas a copy of Robert Jackson's. I had a little brochure, Justice Robert Jackson's article, The County Seat Lawyer, which is magisterial in its writing. But so much of my legal practice has been outside Enid and even outside the United States and occasionally outside the country, that it's only been in the last 2 years, I would say, that it's really been focused in what might be called a county seat. I've been extremely fortunate in the clients, very challenging cases and very interesting clients, both local men and women, as well as political figures and other figures that achieved some infamy or honor from the public, and I had the privilege of representing them. I've represented three of the Republican governors, a number of state representatives and insurance companies and civil rights cases. I've been extremely fortunate.
So you have a wide range of experience in lots of different fields. What kind of law do you find the most satisfying to you or interesting?
Well, the most interesting, I'd say there are three types. One, anything involving the First Amendment is of interest to me. Any homicide case, you know, those are interesting. But I'd say maybe the best is a tax fraud case. And I'm not a tax lawyer, but I do have some pretty good experience in defending people that are either under investigation or indictment for federal tax crimes. And that's kind of a specialty. And I enjoy that work. It's a unique type of work.
Okay. Now, obviously, around here, one of the most famous cases that you had was the Timothy McVeigh case. How did you come to find yourself appointed to that case?
Judge Russell called me. When Mr. McVeigh was arrested in Perry and then brought to Tinker, where he made his initial appearance, Susan Otto was the federal public defender, so she automatically became his lawyer. And she represented Tim for about 2 weeks, but she had told the judge that she was disqualified because her office had been damaged. And so she did not think she could represent him. And Judge Russell, who was the chief judge, agreed. So about 2 weeks later, I received a phone call at my office. I was out of the office, but there was a note on the back of my chair, back here, said Chief Judge Russell wishes for you to call him, and gave his number after 5 and before 5, and I got the office about 6. So I called him and got a voicemail and gave him my home number, told him I was returning his call. And that night about 9 o'clock, which was on May the 5th, 26th anniversary of the day of my coming to Enid, he called me. And I went into my library and answered the phone, and this voice said, as I recall, Mr. Stephen Jones, and I said, yes. And the voice said, Mr. Jones, this is the Department of Justice Watch Command Center in Washington. Please stay on the line for Chief Judge Russell from Oklahoma City. So a few minutes or a few seconds, I heard Judge Russell's voice, and he said, well, I guess you know why I'm calling you.
Did you?
I did not. And I said, I have no idea why you're calling me. And I reached for a legal pad. And he said, well, then I'll come straight to the point. He said, we've had a meeting down here, the other judges and myself, and we have a question to ask you. And he said, the question is, if asked, will you agree to represent someone who has been or will be charged in the bombing of the Murrah building? And I said, well, I don't have a professional problem with it. I understand what you're doing. And I've certainly been involved in controversial cases, but I don't think I've ever been involved in one in which I thought my wife or children or home or even the building where I practice law could be at risk. And I think in fairness, I should talk to them. So the judge said, well, I agree. How long would that take? And I said, 24 hours. He said, call me back at this number tomorrow at 6 o'clock with your answer, which was actually less than 24 hours.
Were your kids in school at the time?
They were each in college.
Okay.
And so about an hour later, Cheryl had been out and she came in. And I still hadn't turned on the lights. I'd been sitting in the library. I said, Raider, that was my nickname for her. I said, come in, I have something to tell you. So she came in the library, and the first question she asked was, why are all the lights off? And I said, Booter, another nickname. the call that you were afraid would come has come. And Cheryl had told me from the beginning, she said, they will call you. And I said, no, they won't. That's not how it works. I'm not even on the panel. And she said, I don't care. You will get the call. And I absolutely did not believe that. Hadn't asked for it. Didn't expect to get a call. And yet, as so often the case, she was right and I was wrong. So I called the judge back after making, I talked with about 9 people in Enid whose views I greatly respected. And then I called the governor because I was the governor's special counsel at the time. And I called Lou Ward, Nancy Davies, Bob Berry, Ray Pickle, who was sheriff, as you recall. And then I called the judge with the number and I said, in response to the question you asked me, I repeated back the question. And I said, the answer is yes. And he said, good.
Were the people you talked to supportive, or was it kind of
a mix? All except the governor.
Okay.
And they were supportive. And to be frank with you, so were the people of Enid. I mean, it was Bob Berry, it might have been Doug France, told me, said, we don't have any objection to you representing McVeigh as long as you don't bring the trial here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I don't think the trial's coming to Enid.
So. You weren't concerned about that? You couldn't have it in Oklahoma City, probably. So you weren't concerned that they, because we do have a federal courthouse.
As soon as Mike Tiger was appointed, he was appointed to represent Terry Nichols, we both agreed we were going to move for a change of venue. Mm-hmm. Judge Alley got the case after the indictment in August. And sui sponte, that is on his own initiative, he moved the trial to Lawton. And both Mike and I thought that was a mistake. So we challenged it. And the Tenth Circuit eventually recused him. And Judge Seymour, who was the chief judge, Stephanie Seymour, appointed Judge Mache, which was an inspired choice.
And was he in Denver at the time?
He was the chief judge of the District of Colorado. So he came down to Oklahoma and presided at the change of venue hearing. And just looking at him, I had no doubt he was going to move it. And he was the chief judge for the District of Colorado, so he was boss there. Had he come down here, wherever he went, he wasn't going to be in charge of the courthouse. There he was in charge, and no one challenged Judge Mache. And on top of that, there was a federal prison outside Denver. And he constructed had constructed a special courtroom for us. Today, that courtroom is probably the model of federal courtrooms. Then it was unprecedented. There were elaborate computer terminals. We had computers, recessed computers for each of the lawyers.
And about what year was this?
The trial was in 97.
Okay.
So
computers were relatively new as a common thing.
It was uncommon. And he treated both sides equally. Mr. Hartzler, who was the nominal head of the prosecution, although the real head was Merrick Garland, who's now the Attorney General, because Joe was in a scooter, he had MS, he couldn't go through the electronic security devices. So the judge said, well, I feel I should also let the defense choose one person not to go through security. And I said, that'll be me, Your Honor. So even the FBI agents had to go through security.
Interesting. So were you given carte blanche with regards to money to spend on the defense at the time? Or was there a budget?
There was no budget.
Was that because they wanted to make sure that the conviction would stand, that they had effective assistance of counsel, that there was no questions about fairness?
Well, I think that ultimately underlay both, all three judges, Russell, Alley, and Mage, they didn't turn down anything I requested. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Judge Mage, we received approximately $18 million. He made it clear all of my office furniture was moved to Denver. I mean, I wasn't in this office, but I moved everything from the Broadway Tower to Denver. So he wanted that.
So y'all actually moved your office and
yes.
spent most of your time during
yes.
the preparations for the
yes.
trial?
Well, yeah. I was the last to move to Denver. The government moved first, then Mike Tiger. I didn't move until January 1 of 19, about 6 months before the trial. First of all the people that I employed to help me were local.
Mm-hmm. So who did you hire? Because I know that you brought several lawyers in for that particular case.
I had a total of 17 lawyers.
Okay. So some of the names that are still around are Mike Roberts.
Mike Roberts.
Was he a new lawyer or was he?
No, Mike had practiced law maybe 7-8 years.
Mm-hmm. Was he here in Enid?
He was here in Enid.
And then Amber Gill.
Amber Gill. I brought her back. She had worked for me before. And I asked her to come back. She was down in Austin. Jim Hankins.
Mm-hmm. And Jim was here for a while.
Jim was, he worked for me, and Bob White.
Uh-huh.
And
They're both in Oklahoma City now.
Yes. I asked Rob Nye, who's now deceased, but Rob was from Enid.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him to come aboard. And Julie Sims, Jeremy Lowry, they both worked for me. They were on the team. And most of our key expert witnesses were abroad because it was very difficult to find experts that we wanted in the United States. Most of them, none of the people involved in bomb trace analysis or the architect of bombs would help us except for one.
Because they were just opposed morally?
Well, most of them had contracts with the government.
Oh, I see.
And I found one that was retired, a wonderful man named Sid Woodcock, and he did it only, I had to agree with him that I would not call him as a witness. And he was a genius. He was enormously helpful. And then for the pathologist, we were able to employ probably the world's most famous pathologist, Sir T.K. Marshall, who had been the chief state pathologist for Northern Ireland and performed over 3,000 autopsies on people that had died as a result of plastic explosives and anvil bombs.
Now, was this your only death penalty case that you've ever had, or have you had others?
No, I probably had 25 others.
Oh, wow, okay. So that, as appointed lawyer and state court?
Some appointed, I represented Roger Dale Stafford on his federal habeas corpus, which was 8 years. Some were appointed, some I was retained.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mostly federal or state cases too?
No, mostly state.
Okay. Interesting. It's something I didn't know. Right. So, now, the death penalty lately has become pretty uncommon around here.
Yes.
For whatever reason, but back then it was fairly common for the prosecutor to seek.
Yes, I had three clients that ultimately were executed: Floyd Medlock, Roger Dale Stafford, and William Denton Jones.
And Mr. McVeigh.
Well, yes, that was federal. Roger Dale Stafford, the sirloin stockade killer, as he was called, was executed on my 55th birthday. I went down to witness the execution at his request.
Were those difficult to... I feel like that, number one, it'd be a substantial amount of pressure, but number two, knowing the aftermath of that, was that difficult for you?
No, it wasn't. I mean, I had a good relationship with Roger. He was a good client and appreciative. He gave me a gift before he was executed. There were three or four clients that received the death penalty that I was able to vacate it on appeal on grounds unique to the case. In other words, it wasn't because of Furman or one of those decisions mm-hmm. of the Supreme Court. Those were others. and then, of course, as you mentioned, Tim McVeigh.
Okay. So, obviously, we know what happened in that particular case. And did you find it difficult to come back to Enid and restart your practice after that? Because if you've been focusing on one case for several years, was it difficult to come back? And
well, it wasn't difficult emotionally to come back. But in terms, I'd given away all the clients I had, so I didn't have any clients when I came back. Probably within the first week or so, I had three cases. But I had more reserves than I anticipated. And so I was able to survive several years until it was built up.
Back up. And then, so there was some notoriety too, obviously, with representing.
Yes, but that works both ways.
Sure.
Some people might call it Johnny Cochran, who's O.J.'s lawyer, O.J. Simpson. I ran into Johnny. We were both on a television program. That's how I met Bill Cosby. And Johnny said, well, your telephone won't ring. Said my telephone didn't ring and I won my case. So sure, I wrote him a letter later and I said, "You're right, partner, call me." So, but it took a while. But then I got a couple of very substantial clients out of Texas that lasted probably 10 years, if not more.
I see.
And so that helped.
Well, was there any thought of leaving Enid at that time?
None.
Okay.
Almost from the beginning. I remember Merrick Garland and I had breakfast after the trial. We both spoke at the American Bar Association convention. And so we had breakfast and he asked me what I was going to do. And I said, well, I'm gonna go back to Enid and practice law. And he said, well, you can go anywhere you want to go. And I said, well, that may be true, although that might be a little exaggeration. I said, after all, I lost. But I said, I don't want to go anywhere. I want to come back to Enid. And so I said, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'll stay with the Department of Justice and maybe get appointed federal judge.
Which he did.
And I supported him when he was nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court by President Obama. I'd been the Republican nominee for the United States Senate 10 years before, so I contacted a Republican senator that I knew, including the two from Oklahoma.
And did they both vote for his nomination?
No. But
Attorney General.
Well, no, they voted for Supreme Court. His nomination never came up.
Never came up.
But they did grant him a courtesy interview.
Uh-huh.
And Merrick, he was chief judge of the District of Columbia Circuit, which is the second most powerful federal court in the country. And he called me one day, maybe towards the end of Mr. Obama's term, and thanked me for supporting him. And we had a nice conversation.
I think you maybe even wrote a letter to the editor.
I wrote a lot of letters. But
I think I remember reading one in
but newspaper. I did write newspaper, and I supported him for Attorney General. As soon as Mr. Biden won, I started calling my Democrat friends. And I thought he probably would be appointed.
He's very well respected.
He is
even by most conservatives.
Well, yes, very well respected, and was certainly cordial and professional. I asked him to arrange a private appointment with Attorney General Reno, which he did, and we had a. There might have been some friction between myself and some of the prosecution team. There was never any with General Garland. He was. And he was younger than I am, younger then. He was professional, mm-hmm. and cordial.
Okay. Am I wrong in remembering that maybe they voted for our senators now?
Our senators, for attorney. Yes, Senator Inhofe and Senator Langford both voted for him.
For attorney general. General. Okay, that's what I thought. And that was breaking with some of the party.
Yes, oh yes, yes.
Okay. You're on the downside of your career, I would guess. Any thought to retiring anytime soon?
No.
You're just going to practice like most lawyers do until it's time to not?
No, if I didn't practice law, I'd be dead 6 months. I intend to practice.
Cheryl might kick you out of the house too.
That's probably the greater. I tell people that I've tried to retire several times, but my creditors are against it. So.
Well, talk a little bit about Cheryl. She, I've gotten to know her a little bit because she writes for the Enid Monthly.
She enjoys that very much.
And she wrote for the Daily Oklahoman for decades.
Yes,
recipes for them, and she's a fantastic cook and chef. And so, talk a little bit about Cheryl and what that relationship.
Sure. Cheryl went to high school in Guymon, and when she was in high school, she won the Miss Teenage Oklahoma contest and was one of the finalists at the national pageant in Dallas, which was filmed nationwide. All of Guymon supported her. It was a very heartwarming thing. Then she went to OSU, and she met a woman that I dated who's from Enid, who's quite prominent in her own right, Letitia Chambers. And Letitia, most people do not know this, but Letitia was the first woman in the history of the United States Senate to be staff director of a standing Senate committee. She was staff director of Labor and Public Welfare under both Senator Williams and Senator Ted Kennedy. And she then was one of our ambassadors to the United Nations. She formed a very successful lobbying company. She's retired now. She married the last Republican congressman from Vermont. Well, Letitia and I dated when I was in Enid and she was getting her doctorate degree. She wanted to go to Washington, and I had come from Washington, and I didn't desire to go back. So we both realized, you know, ultimately this is not going to go anywhere. But she's the one, she came by my office one day and she said, I have somebody you should meet. I know somebody you should meet. And so she introduced me to Cheryl, and magic happened.
All right. Well, and she's a great homemaker. And did she have other jobs besides writing
the school teacher? She was a teacher at Skyline Elementary School before we were married. And after the trial in Denver was over, I told her, I said, Booter, this is your time now. And the Oklahoman asked her to be their food columnist every Wednesday. Wednesday. So every Wednesday for 17 years, she had to write 500 words, which towards the end was a major effort. I mean, because it was not about restaurants, it was about food. And she had a wonderful time. She had a private interview of almost an hour with Julia Childs. And she had some very small group meetings with Martha Stewart, and made several trips to Europe to go to various schools and kitchens there. And she fixes dinner for me every evening. No one in Enid, I think, eats as well as I do.
I bet you that's true. Now, we briefly glossed over your time as a politician, a professional politician. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was?
Well, I ran for office several times. Sometimes won the primary, never a general election. But most of my work in politics has been either as a lawyer for a candidate or an office holder or the national committee, rather than being a candidate myself.
And I've heard you say often to people that I'll either support you or be against you, whichever helps you more.
I call my friends and I say, tell me who your opponent is. I'll send them a check.
All right. Well, so what did you find as a candidate that you said you ran several times? What was the highest office you ran for?
United States Senator. I was the nominee of the party for the Senate in 1990.
Okay. And that was before Oklahoma was a Republican state.
Well, I ran against David Boren. Nichols was the other senator. Uh-huh. And we did not have the prominence in 1990 that we have today.
Do you regret, are you kind of sad that you didn't win elected office?
No, not at all. Most of my life, I had ambition to be a senator. I wrote a biography of a senator. I worked for the Senate.
Which one?
Chapman Revercomb was an obscure Republican from West Virginia.
Why did you find him interesting?
A high school experience. And Senator's long been gone, and I did it for his family. Mm-hmm. And there was another Republican that served with him briefly. And so they asked me, would I do it? Well, I'd admired the senator for so long. So Ann Bradley and Bob Meyer helped me. It was privately printed, and I presented it to them at Christmas. And it was a wonderful opportunity for me. I worked for Senator Percy, I worked in the Senate, and I was a candidate for the Senate.
Okay.
So I feel like the 4 months I was the Republican nominee for the Senate was almost like being a senator. I mean, when you're a nominee for the Senate, you know, they bring you up to Washington, you go to the meetings and the luncheons of the policy committee, and they treat you royally. You get all the internal memoranda, and of course, all that stops when you lose. But they even, the last thing they do is they write you a letter and say the Republican Senate conference will meet on Tuesday after the election day. Hope you can join us. Which, of course, I didn't, but because I wasn't elected. But it was a very friendly group of people.
Up until recently, it seemed like it continued to be so. Republicans and Democrats were really collegial in the Senate, but it seems like that's changed a little bit in the last couple
Absolutely.
Of years.
Absolutely, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm.
President Biden had even mentioned that before he was elected president, that he felt that was unfortunate that they had lost some of that collegiality.
When I worked in the House, it was completely different. There were coalitions. People worked together. If you were opposed, you nevertheless had a constructive opposition. That doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately.
Well, good. Well, I could sit and talk to you for another hour if we had it, but I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Well, Bobby, thank you for your interest and thank you for your friendship.
No, I thank you for your friendship and certainly everything that you've done for the community. And between you and Dick McKnight, I think that you guys have story upon story upon story about Enid. Let me ask you one more question. Was there somebody that you found that you wanted to emulate or was a great mentor to you as a lawyer here in Enid that you were very proud to have an association with?
Well, I certainly enjoyed, even though Frank Carter and I had that difference, as you walked in, you pass Frank Carter's portrait. Mm-hmm. I have his portrait hanging in my office. I greatly benefited from my relationship with both Mr. Carter and Senator Auchin. I have his two certificates, one admitting him to the United States Supreme Court Bar and the other to the Bar of Oklahoma. Mr. Carter was the last lawyer in Enid that read the law. He didn't go to law school. I think the greatest trial lawyer that I ever watched or knew was Harold Singer. Mm. And I'd say right behind Harold was E.B. Mitchell Jr. Both of them were here. And I didn't think I was a lawyer until I won a jury case against the two of them, and I finally did.
Were they civil cases?
They were civil cases. Mm-hmm. And Harold died much too young. He was absolutely the best I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of lawyers.
Interesting. Well, if there's any advice that you could give to a young lawyer, a young professional here in Enid, what would it be?
What Harold told me, keep regular office hours, stay sober, and return phone calls.
That's fair. I like it. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Bobby.
Appreciate
thank you.
You very much.
Yes, sir.